Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Linda Gunter, the co-founder of Beyond Nuclear in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Linda specializes in media and development, human rights, the nuclear fuel chain, and the myths surrounding the French nuclear program. Prior to her environmental advocacy work, Linda was an award-winning public relations professional and worked as a journalist for Reuters, The Times in the UK, The New York Times, and many other newspapers and magazines. She is also a broadcaster with the USA and Prime Television Networks. In 2001, she co-authored the landmark report, License to Kill, exposing the high toll taken on animal life due to the routine operation of coastal nuclear power plants. Linda Gunter, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thanks, Helen. It's fun to be on.
Yeah. Okay, now the nuclear industry persistently says, both in Australia and Canada and the US and everywhere else, look, it's all right. 80% of the French electricity comes from nuclear power. They're okay. So what's the problem? So I want you to answer that at all levels, please, Linda. As you speak French fluently and you've kept up with
oui, bien sûr. Well, first of all, it puzzles me why just because you get 80% of your electricity from one source, that makes it a success. I mean, it's a very superficial soundbite.
Right.
And unfortunately, these days, a superficial soundbite is about as long a time as you get to say too much of anything. And so the public and the legislators here in the States especially have just taken that on board and accepted it without digging any further to say, well, what are the implications of 80% of your nuclear and of your energy, of your electricity coming from nuclear reactors? And honestly, the first thing that results from that heavy dependence on one source is an incredible amount of nuclear waste. High level, in Europe, they have something called intermediate level and low level. It doesn't really matter, as you know, what you call it. It's dangerous, whether you get a big dose quickly or small doses over time. And so the French have really put all their nuclear eggs in one basket. Now, one of the things that people imagine is, well, in that case, they must have a fantastic amount of energy independence, which is not the case. Because, of course, you know, I actually take exception to this word nuclear because I think it sort of neutralized the whole thing. You know, we talk about coal power and we talk about wind energy and stuff, and we talk about the source. But in nuclear, it's just this sort of bland word that masks where nuclear energy comes from, which is, of course, uranium.
Yeah.
So we should really call it uranium power.
Oh, and that's a good idea.
When you realize uranium power, you have to find uranium somewhere, and so you find it by mining.
Yeah.
And since the French have closed their 210 uranium mines, they import all their fuel for their nuclear plants, which means that they are just as energy dependent on foreign countries as we in the States feel we are on oil.
How interesting.
So that hasn't helped them at all. Then you have to start to look at where they're importing this uranium from and what kind of conditions the miners who work those mines are facing. And absolutely across the board, it's coming from your country, Australia, where the Aborigines have taken the brunt of the impact of the health impacts of uranium mines, from Niger, former French colony, where the nomadic Tuareg are being displaced for uranium mines and they're taking the impact again, health and environmental. From Canada, where a lot of times it's the Canadian Indian bands who've had to deal with this. So it disproportionately targets minorities and indigenous peoples, most of whom never see, you know, one watt of benefit from that uranium mining. So, I mean, I could talk for hours about all the problems about France.
I want
but
you
the fact
to.
Is that the fact is that it's absolutely, you know, first of all, a very non-democratic system. It came out of the weapons system. The first nuclear reactors that they had in France were really designed to produce plutonium for their nuclear bombs.
Yeah.
And Therefore, there's a tremendous amount, it's state-owned, you know, 90% of Areva, which is a big nuclear utility in France, is state-owned.
Yeah.
Therefore, the ability for the public to have any kind of look inside what's going on is highly limited. In fact, both the bombs and the nuclear reactors are ultimately controlled by the president, who right now is Nicolas Sarkozy, who loves nuclear and is trying to sell it all over the world, no matter to whom or what kind of regime. So, you know, you start with the uranium mines. The 210 that France had are closed. So what's happened there? Well, they just basically walked away. I went to France. I've just been, actually, recently, but I went just over a year ago and walked one of these abandoned uranium mine sites. It's in the middle of the countryside. There's absolutely no signage posted anywhere.
Oh, no.
We took a Geiger counter with us. I mean, there was one sign maybe saying private, keep out, but there was certainly no one to keep you out, and kids had been camping there and hikers walked through. It's pretty. It's a bucolic, you know, bit of Brittany countryside.
Yeah.
So we walked around, and, you know, the readings are going higher and higher, and there were all sorts of hotspots leading from where they mined it to the pool, you know, the runoff pool.
Yeah.
And not a single iota of, you know, protective signage around to let people know what was there.
Yeah.
Then the tailings from the mining and milling of these mines have been used in, believe it or not, playgrounds for children's school.
Oh, God.
To pave parking lots at soccer stadiums and ski resorts in the walls of buildings that people use for their various industries. And so this radioactive mess has spread into people's daily lives. And this was actually exposed earlier this year on a television program where they showed radioactive rocks in the parking lot of a ski resort. They measured them on camera, showed the levels of radioactivity were quite high. And that has actually since been cleaned up. Now, what happens in France, because, of course, it's all government-controlled, and the last thing the Sarkozy government wants is any kind of black eye, you know, for the nuclear industry, because this is his number one product that he's trying to export. You know, what happens is that they try and skew the science. So, for example, at the soccer stadium parking lot, football, as we say in England and Australia, I think, they refused to sort of acknowledge at first the French authorities that there could be a problem. So they hired their own state agency to do so-called radiological testing.
Yeah.
And they just picked a couple of spots here and there and said there was no problem. In behind them went a very first-rate radiological laboratory, which was actually formed independently in France after the Chernobyl accident to measure all the hot spots along the eastern border of France. And they went in and they did proper, you know, they did multiple sites and controls, and they found extremely elevated rates of radioactivity. And it's taken 5 years to get the government to actually clean this public parking lot at a football stadium up. But it's that level of sort of obfuscation and, you know, not telling people about things that really plagues the French nuclear system. And probably the pinnacle, or the nadir, if you prefer, of the whole setup is reprocessing.
Before you get into that, Linda, I want to ask you, what role has Le Monde played? Is that also under government control? I think it used to be when I went to France in 1972 to complain to the French government about their French atmospheric testing in the Pacific, and we got a high fallout in Australia. First of all, we saw Mitterrand, and he said, if I get to be president, I'll close down all the nuclear reactors. And secondly, I was told that Le Monde was pretty well controlled by the government. Is that accurate or not?
For the newspaper, Le Monde?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's true at all. In fact, I think Le Monde does some of the... It's certainly not true now. I mean, Le Monde
does some of the
best pioneering investigative reporting that I've seen in as a sort of mainstream newspaper. There are some more left-leaning, not too left-leaning, because in Europe, of course, the left is quite pro-nuclear. The communist parties in all those European countries are heavily pro-nuclear.
Oh.
So that's an issue politically. But, for example, there's a reporter named Elvi Kempf, who I met actually a year ago. He came here to speak at the Green Fest because he'd written a book, which is actually a brilliant book. It's not about nuclear. It's called How the Rich Are Destroying the Earth, and it's an incredible indictment of how wealth has just led to so many problems.
Oh.
But he was always the beat reporter for Le Monde on the nuclear front, and he's done some really, really good work. And so I don't feel, actually, that Le Monde is the problem. Although, having said that, there's clearly a sort of a blackout to a large degree by the press on this issue when it comes to the opposing point of view. It's more true with television because there's a buddy named Martin Bouygues, who's a friend of Sarkozy's, who controls a couple of the television networks. And so, you know, the rest of them are state-owned. So it's a bit like the Berlusconi situation where, you know, the television networks have a limited opportunity to really dig in. But
France
showed this.
Yeah.
Well, Italy is a sort of lost cause because Berlusconi controls practically all the television networks.
Right.
In France, some are controlled by Sarkozy, you know, by the government or by Martin Bouygues, his buddy. But, for example, France 3, which showed the piece about the abandoned mines, you know, they did a long investigative piece about the abandoned mines. You know, it was an excellent piece, and it went on air and it caused a big to-do. And then you've got Arte, which is a Franco-German network that just showed an incredible film, actually, called Waste, the Nuclear Nightmare, in English. And I'm trying to get through to the right people to get the rights to get this scene here as far and wide as possible and up on Capitol Hill. And this piece actually caused quite a scandal in France because it looks not only at France, but it does look very clearly at France and also at the reprocessing piece, which we'll talk about in a minute. But it looks at the former Soviet Union. It looks at the U.S., at Hanford, for example. And one of the things that came out was that, you know, the French basically lie to the world about having solved, you know, how little waste they have from reprocessing. It's all under one floor in one room at the reprocessing site. And this program said, well, you know, what about the rest of it? Where does that go? And they said, well, you know, it goes to Russia, and that's sort of their problem. We don't know what they do with it, but it's basically recycled to them. And they went to Russia and they went to Siberia and they found this waste sitting in tin cans outside in a sort of parking lot style, side by side. I mean, they looked at it, you know, from Google Earth or something.
Yeah.
You could see it. I mean, you know, it was that obvious. And of course, they showed the journey it took up to get there. I mean, just incredible amount of risk involved in transporting this stuff. So that kind of debunked the idea that they actually dispose of or recycle their waste. But that program then, when this piece about, you know, the Electricité de France, which is the big, you know, electricity utility in France, which is also state-owned, was shown to have exported its waste to Siberia, where it's just sitting around outside, that provoked, at least publicly, I mean, what will happen on the inside, one doesn't really know, but at least publicly, the ecology minister said, well, now we have to have an investigation into this practice, you know. So, I mean, it's hard to believe they didn't know what was being done with this waste, but that's really, you know, their idea of recycling, because they try to call this recycling, reprocessing, is to pump waste, liquid waste into the sea and aerial waste into the air and ship the rest to Siberia.
Oh,
and that's
God.
Recycling. You know, it's a joke.
Is that,
except that it's really serious.
I'm interviewing Linda Gunter, who is the co-founder of Beyond Nuclear, located in Tacoma Park near Washington, D.C. Linda, the waste in Siberia, I read that was uranium, but is it actually high-level waste from reactors?
It's depleted uranium.
Oh, it's depleted uranium.
Yeah.
Uranium-238.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Now I want you to tell us about what they're doing with the high-level waste at all their nuclear power plants, 67, I think. What have they done with that? Is it sitting in cooling pools or what? What are they
doing?
Well,
they've got 58 operating reactors, which are American reactors, almost all of them, Westinghouse, Sun and off.
So
when I talk to the French activists, they say, well, we don't, you know, what's all this stuff about the great French nuclear program? We have American reactors.
Oh.
They're not French at all. You know, they're trying to claim that they're not even French. So what they do is they've decided to reprocess, which is a chemical separation in which the fuel is cut up and soaked in acid, and you extract plutonium and fissile uranium. So, of course, that gives you plutonium. And although they say they recycle this fuel, most of that plutonium hasn't gone anywhere. In fact, they've got 81 metric tons of plutonium sitting at the reprocessing site, which is on this beautiful peninsula in Normandy. You know, it's a bucolic setting except for this hideous facility. And it's sitting there in fundamentally Coca-Cola-sized cans. So, again, a huge proliferation risk.
Well, tell us why it's proliferation risk, Linda.
Because plutonium is the fissile, is the trigger for a nuclear weapon, and you don't need, as you know, a whole lot of it to make a nuclear bomb.
How much do you need?
I believe you need, well, you can do it, I think, with as little as 5 to 6 pounds, right?
Correct. And then why is it sitting in separate amounts of Coca-Cola-sized amounts?
They have no idea what to do with it. And so it has no place to go. They have no repository. And theoretically, at least, well, we can talk about this since they're a signatory to the brilliant, not-so-brilliant nuclear non-proliferation treaty. They're not supposed to be expanding their nuclear arsenal, so they don't need it, theoretically, to make new nuclear weapons. The other thing about the reprocessing at La Hague, not all of this plutonium is French. Some of it comes from other countries, because the French imported irradiated reactor fuel from other countries and reprocessed it for them. And in theory, the waste resulting from that is supposed to be returned to the country of origin. But most of the time, that's not happened. So France has become this sort of de facto waste dump for Japan and Germany and Belgium and other countries.
And Australia.
From which it's imported this fuel.
Yeah.
And so it's accumulated. And so that's part of the problem. And then what happens in this process is you generate a huge amount of so-called low-level liquid waste. And they got around being in violation of dumping this waste by not putting it into containers. You know, there's some brilliant footage, actually, in this waste movie of the old footage of when they just tossed the drums of radioactive waste overboard from those ships out in the sea. And Greenpeace and others fought tooth and nail to get that prevented. And there was a London dumping convention passed which says you are not allowed to dump waste in containers into the sea. So La Hague just discharges it in liquid form through these pipes. And if you put that waste into a container and dumped it in that same body of water, you would violate that convention. But because it's just pumped out in liquid form, they can pump, you know, hundreds and thousands of gallons of this out every year into the sea. And then there are the aerial discharges that go out into the air, carbon-14, krypton-85. Krypton-85 is found 90,000 times higher levels of krypton-85 coming out of the La Hague aerial discharge pipe than you find in nature. And those isotopes have been tracked all around the world. The liquid discharges have been tracked as far as the Arctic. Oh. And, of course, they get compounded by the Sellafield reprocessing site on the west coast of England, which also discharges into the sea. So you can imagine. I mean, the Irish Sea is supposedly the most radioactively contaminated sea on the planet because of the combination of those two reprocessing sites.
Well, Linda,
the Irish are hopping mad about that.
Oh, I know. And they've got clusters of cancer and leukemia amongst various populations of children. But That waste that they're pumping out from La Hague is a combination of nitric acid in which the chopped up fuel rods were dissolved, huge amounts of fission products, plus things called transuranics like plutonium called americium and einsteinium and neptunium, etc. And they're deadly, deadly. And so it's not low-level waste at all, Linda.
Absolutely. And that's
so they're pumping out high level waste into the sea.
Yes.
How much?
And of course, as you mentioned, the leukemia clusters, that's a very interesting point. Because again, what happened in France was there was a study done by a Dr. Viel of leukemia clusters, particularly amongst youth, but just along sort of down sea, if you like, downstream from La Hague. And his study found elevated rates of leukemia, especially amongst youth, in those communities.
Mm.
So the French government said, oh, well, wait a minute here. You know, we don't think this is, you haven't done this right. This is obviously not right. I mean, it's very difficult to prove, obviously, but nevertheless. So they authorized they got a sort of coalition together of 40 bodies to say, right, we're just going to redo this properly, which is, you know, a euphemism. And what they did was they used the Hiroshima-Nagasaki bomb model to do the study, which, of course, then, since that's completely inapplicable, showed very, you know, really no indication of elevated rates of leukemia. And the lab that I referenced earlier with whom we're working pulled out this study because this is bogus science. I mean, you're not using the right protocols, you're not using the right models. It was a sort of witch hunt against the doctor to try and completely discredit him. And so that's what happens with the nuclear industry. You know, when you get at one of their many Achilles heels, they just go on the attack and they try to destroy you. You know, the same thing happened recently. It's a little bit of a different subject, but there was an effort, one of the vice presidents of Areva, because they're so eager to mine in Niger. So Areva is the big nuclear industry, government-owned body in France, and Areva does, you know, the soup to nuts of the nuclear industry. They mine, they mill, they enrich uranium, they produce nuclear reactors, and they manage waste. I mean, they do the whole lot, and they reprocess. And they have various sort of, I guess they call them filial, you know, so they have different agreements with other companies so that they don't have to sort of directly do all the work themselves. So one of the vice presidents of Areva was so eager to get this deal done in Niger, which they've done now, to build the biggest uranium mine in the world, that he dismissed the Tuareg, who are the nomadic folks who are fighting back, as imaginary, basically, as dreams in women's minds, and, you know, just that they don't exist. So there was a lawsuit brought against him by two groups. One was a German group, actually, and the other was a Tuareg group in France. And the lawyer who represented those groups was viciously, verbally, attacked and threatened by the Areva lawyers and told that he was lying and that he should be disbarred. And it was only that, you know, eventually a group of the whatever the sort of legal club is in France went to this guy's defense that he was able to emerge with his reputation intact. The suit, of course, was dismissed because they managed to come up with some sort of probably bogus thing that these organizations had to have been around for at least 3 years to have standing. So it was dismissed for lack of standing. But that's the sort of aggressive tack that's taken if you try in France to challenge the nuclear conglomerate.
I'm interviewing Linda Gunter, who's the co-founder or the founder of Beyond Nuclear, a wonderful anti-nuclear organization in the United States. Yes, I just want to comment on that, Linda. I've been writing articles here in Australia against uranium mining and nuclear power, and I get the same sort of blogging attacks. Not to question my data or the data of other scientists, but attacking me personally, calling me a Luddite, or now they're calling it Caldecottism. And obviously these people are paid by the nuclear industry to discredit and try and get rid of their critics. And it's obviously happening all over the world. Now I want to move on and ask you, how much high-level waste from La Hague over the years, and it's quite old, isn't it? How long has it been in operation? How much high-level waste has been discharged into the ocean, Linda? And talk about food chains.
You know, I don't know the answer to that question in terms of how much, and I don't know that anybody really can be sure, because how do you measure it and whose figures do you believe?
Yeah.
You know, we certainly wouldn't believe the industry's figures. So it's hard to know, but obviously when you put it into the ocean and it affects fish, what, plankton and fish and everybody that eats everybody else in the ocean, you create a threat to human health, also to the health of animals. I mean, that's something, as you mentioned at the start of the show, that my husband Paul and I co-authored really a book. It was published as a report about the impact to aquatic species from nuclear power plants. This wasn't even about reprocessing, which is, you know, orders of magnitude more serious in terms of the amount of discharge. But one of the things that happened around The Hague was they did have to close that area to fishing at one point because the levels were so high.
Oh,
you know, and I think it should be closed permanently to fishing. I mean, what would possess you ever to eat the fish caught in that area, given the biomagnification from one organism to the next? of all these radioactive isotopes that have been pumped out there. So, you know, it's such a deadly mess, and it's absolutely gained the French nothing whatsoever. In fact, they've done analysis to show that the cost of their nuclear electricity has been considerably higher because they chose the plutonium route, first of all, their disastrous breeder reactor program, which closed, and then the reprocessing. Because one of the other things they do with a minuscule amount of this plutonium is they do put it back in about 20 of their reactors that can use a fuel called MOX, but they can only use a small percentage of their fuel.
MOX is
mixed oxide, which is another sort of rather techie term, but it just means that it's plutonium mixed with uranium.
Yeah.
So instead of the traditional uranium fuel, there's a little bit of plutonium in there. Well, you know, as you know perfectly well, the fissioning process in a reactor creates plutonium. So you put plutonium in and you get plutonium out. So they haven't really reduced their amount of plutonium at all, but they've got a really hot fuel, irradiated fuel, at the end of this, because the MOX reactors produce a much more highly radioactive fuel, which can't be reprocessed. So now they've got more waste, which is more difficult waste to manage, and they haven't really reduced their plutonium stockpile at all.
Well,
so it's just a sort of way to say, well, we're recycling it, you know. But you got to look at the other end and see what's coming out. They're not recycling it at all.
Right. Well, now what I want to know is, because the nuclear industry keeps saying, well, look at France, 80% of their electricity comes from nuclear power. Have there been... Well, first of all, you talked about hot spots all up and down the French coast. I want you to discuss that. Have there been any epidemiological studies of people, or particularly children, living around their 57, is it, nuclear power plants? Is the incidence of leukemia and cancer higher? Have there been those studies done, Linda?
They haven't done the studies around plants. Where they did the studies was around the Largue reprocessing site. They did do that study in Germany, however, and they did find elevated rates of childhood leukemia within a 5-kilometre distance of nuclear power plants. So the Germans have looked at this, but the French have not. I think it's highly unlikely. I can't think of, you know, what would motivate them to do such a study, given what we know they'll find, and they don't want to find that because they don't want any bad publicity about nuclear.
Well,
you know, secondly, if they did do the study, it would be very hard to imagine that it would have any scientific integrity because they're not going to use the right protocols. So they haven't done it. The hotspots are not on the coast. The hotspots are from the Chernobyl fallout, from the Chernobyl accident on the border. So on the eastern border of France, that's where the plume traveled and fell. And that's where the hotspots have been found, primarily. I mean, obviously, we know the Chernobyl cloud went everywhere. It came to the east coast of the United States. But in terms of levels of concentration, they have, and this has not been done by the French government, this has been done by CRIRAD, the lab in Valence in France, that's what actually got them started, because the French were lied to by their government when the Chernobyl reactor exploded. One of the French ministers said, you know, we don't have to worry because the plume won't come to France.
That's right.
We don't have to take any protective measures.
That's right.
We don't have to keep your kids indoors. You can eat the vegetables. And so the French basically got duped into eating fresh produce, letting their kids play outside. They got dosed by their own, you know, government, not negligence so much, but lying in order to protect the reputation of the nuclear industry. Because you can imagine, I mean, Chernobyl was sort of their worst nightmare in Europe because they really felt the effects directly. In Italy, there was a referendum in 1987, 1 year later, in which the Italians voted to close their reactors. They had, by then, only 3 of the 4 operating, and they closed them in a national referendum because of the Chernobyl accident. So that's why, despite what we hear about everybody in France loves their nuclear energy, that's not true. And there's a huge level of suspicion, justifiably so, amongst the French about the nuclear power industry and the government, because they were so, you know, irresponsibly deceived in 1986 about what was coming over and what was dropping on them from that Chernobyl accident.
Well, I know the French government said that the fallout stopped right at the French border, and there have been some studies, I don't know by whom, to show that there is an increased incidence of malignancy cancer in France related to Chernobyl, and also in Sweden, where they got a very high fallout too. And I'd just like to tell you an apocryphal story. I went with our then Deputy Prime Minister Jim Kenz in 1972 to see the French government to complain to them about blowing up nuclear weapons in our area of the Pacific. And in Adelaide, where I lived, we got a very high fallout in our drinking water. And so we were sitting with these men, and Jim Kenz said, well, why are you testing them in the Pacific? And the French government said to us, well, our bombs are perfectly safe. So Jim said, well, if they're safe, why don't you blow them up in the Mediterranean? And their faces turned bright white and they said, mon Dieu, there are too many people living around the Mediterranean. So for the first time in my young life as a young doctor and a young mother, I was sitting opposite wicked politicians who really didn't give a damn if some Australian children developed leukemia and cancer as a result of their tests. And that was a very big turning point in my life. And I have to say that how dare the nuclear industry use France as an example of to talk about the benefits of nuclear power when no one's ever looked epidemiologically at the incidence of cancer related to their nuclear reactors, number one. And I'm raving a bit now, Linda. Number two, my daughter married a French count. And so she's a countess, a less likely countess you could hardly hope to see. But anyway, he's got a sister who is very famous as a model and a commentator on television. I have to tell you that Caroline knows nothing about nuclear power. None of the family know. They're supremely ignorant, but quite arrogant in a way to say, you know, well, everything's hunky-dory. So at a basic level, I find the French public, and that's just one example, to be very, very ignorant about what's going on. And I would just warn people not to drink French wine, not to eat French food.
Not French food. Oh, no.
Well, Linda.
That's not worth living then.
Well, you know, you can cook it yourself. But you don't know, Linda, what food contains cesium-137 or strontium-90 or plutonium. And one-third of the inventory of the plutonium at Chernobyl got out, which would be about, you know, over 100...
So that must be true of Italy and other places
pounds.
Too, you know. But I don't think that ignorance is restricted to France. I mean, I find the level of what people don't know in the United States is breathtaking as well.
Give us Give us an example.
You know, well, I mean, when you go out and talk to people, I don't think... I mean, I can give myself as an example, really, because before I did this work, I was a tennis reporter, believe it or not, and I bought a house, and my father, who was a big-time anti-nuclear activist, asked me whether I had ever thought about where my electricity comes from when I turn the light switch on. And I told him quite honestly, no. You know, that. And he said, well, do you know how it comes on? I said, not really. You know, it's all sort of magic to me. You turn this switch and your lights come on. But I had never really thought about the process involved in getting that electricity to my house, nor looked really closely at my bill to see what the percentage of which kind of electricity I was using. Mm. Now, I've had, obviously, a sea change in my life in terms of being initiated into this. And, you know, I was not in a sort of burrow somewhere. I mean, I had this piece in my family background. I wasn't ignorant about nuclear weapons or nuclear power.
And your father was a physicist, right?
Yes, he was a physicist. But I still hadn't really, you know, it wasn't something I bothered to think about day to day. And I think that's true of a lot of people. It's not that they don't want to know. It's just that they don't know. I mean, last week I was in Carmel. I met some dear friends of mine, and I talked to one of them, and he said, well, I don't really think I'm the sort of person that has a strong view either for or against nuclear power, you know, because I don't really know enough about it. And I think that that about sums it up, and that our biggest challenge as advocates against nuclear energy and nuclear weapons is to get information to people, because if they know, I think if they know, a lot of them will feel differently. I just can't see how one can know this and then sleep peacefully at night and not think, okay, you've got to do something about it. I mean, one of the things that I did sort of as Beyond Nuclear, but also as Linda Gunter, was in Tacoma Park is a nuclear-free city. You know, nuclear-free cities are basically cities that will not do business with any company that has anything to do with nuclear weapons manufacturing. And on the 25th anniversary of this, and we were, I think, the second city in the country to be a nuclear-free city, I spoke publicly, but before our mayor and council, and said, really, if you want to call yourself a nuclear-free city, you should be truly nuclear-free. We get about 40% of our electricity in this community from nuclear energy. If we're going to call ourselves nuclear-free, we should be buying 100% renewables.
Yeah.
And guess what's happened? Tacoma Park is today, the city buys 100% wind power. So it is truly nuclear-free. You know, I looked at my bill and I saw where the nuclear energy, electricity was coming from. So I think it's just, you know, it's an awareness-raising process. It's an educational process. It's getting people to understand the insane risks that we're willing to take to let these reactors operate in this country. You know, we are willing to chance risking losing the Eastern Seaboard or New York City completely for the, you know, indefinite future just to keep these decrepit old reactors running. It's madness, and it's not. We don't have to do it. We can go to the renewable energy route. But the reason we do it is money.
It's not money for you or we. It's the money for the utilities who want to push out as much electricity at a rather cheap price, charge the customers a lot, and keep doing it for as long as they can. But what really, there are several things that have gotten to me recently, Linda. One is that the one accident at Chernobyl contaminated a whole continent, so that there are lambs growing in Cumbria and Wales and somewhere else I read the other day that are so full of cesium-137, so radioactive they can't be sold on the market. That's a long way from Chernobyl. And if there was a meltdown in one of the reactors in the US, that could contaminate, depending on the wind blowing direction, the whole of America. Then the next point is, if the Second World War was fought today, Europe would be uninhabitable for the rest of time because it's covered with reactors. And the third point is, this only occurred to me the other day, we talk about nuclear war, that thousands of weapons are on hair trigger alert in Russia and America, ready to blow up the world with a decision time of 3 minutes by either Medvedev or Obama. But a nuclear war would produce the meltdown also of about 440 nuclear power plants around the world. And apart from nuclear winter and a short ice age created by such a catastrophe, the truth is that the planet would be virtually uninhabitable forevermore. And that has only just sort of hit my conscious level. Do you want to comment on that?
I think it's, you know, it's beyond belief that we persist with this kind of insanity.
Yeah.
You know, you paint a very bleak picture, but I think that it's oftentimes just too much for people to take on board, and so they'd rather just not deal with it at all. But I think it's also encouraged by a culture that is just endemic to this, which is that there's some sort of testosterone-loaded cachet about having something nuclear. And so it's been to date bombs, you know, that somehow you're potent and powerful just by possessing these things. And now countries have cottoned on to the idea that you can get there with civilian nuclear plants. I mean, that's how India, Pakistan, Israel, South Africa, and North Korea got their bomb programs, with civilian reactors. And that even just having the potential to transition to nuclear weapons gives you some sort of bluster and power in your region. And until you remove the psychology that having something nuclear, you know, boosts your potency as a country, we'll never get away from it. And that, to me, is a fundamental problem with the Non-Proliferation Treaty in Article 4, because it gives countries that sign the treaty and promise not to make nuclear weapons the inalienable right to so-called peaceful nuclear energy technology. Now, why do you give the compensation prize for not doing nuclear bombs? Why do you give them nuclear reactors? Why wouldn't you? If they need electricity, let's give them something they can use. You know, if we're talking about the Middle East, we say, okay, you promise not to make nuclear weapons, we'll give you, you know, a whole solar program. I mean, that would be a true incentive, because it actually is useful, you know, and applicable to the place that they're in, where it's very sunny and windy. I mean, you could do wind power too. But it's the fact that we're saying, we're never going to get go of this thing that nuclear has some sort of cachet. So in order for you to agree not to make the bomb, we'll still give you something nuclear so you don't feel so bad, you know, that you've kind of got this potency. Well, of course, the Middle Eastern countries especially that are lining up to do nuclear programs, you know, don't need nuclear energy to turn their lights on. They might need electricity, more electricity. But if they do, that's not your first choice. It's only their first choice because it keeps them sort of one foot in the nuclear club. And that's the problem.
Do you think, so Linda...
You've got to get away from that.
Yeah. I'm interviewing Linda Gunter, the founder of Beyond Nuclear. Do you think, Linda, then... that nuclear power and weapons are a metaphorical equivalent of Viagra?
I think there's definitely, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, so I can't delve into this.
Why
but
not?
I think that there's, but there is definitely, I mean, I did use testosterone. I mean, I do think that that's part of it, that this sort of bellicosity that, you know, for example, Iran, where it's at right now is a case in point, you know, that why do they need to develop nuclear energy? Well, one of the reasons is profit, because then they can export oil and it's much more profitable to export it and to use it. But the other is obviously related to the possibility of developing nuclear weapons, given where they are and who their enemies are and so forth. And so I think it's all absolutely tied to it. Now, whether it's a uniquely male issue, I don't know. I mean, we've had some pretty hawkish women leaders over the years in various countries. So it seems to be a culture that develops when you get into that kind of position of power, no matter what gender you are. And I don't know how you undo that. I feel, unfortunately, rather pessimistic about the human species in that regard.
I've suggested we put oxytocin, which is the nurturing female hormone, in the water supply of the world. Anyway, that's just an aside. I want to ask you about the boiling water reactors in the United States, Linda Gunter. How many are there? And they have their fuel pools on the roof. I want you to describe that and how much radiation is in their fuel pools. And I want you to talk about the discharges from boiling water reactors, both into the air and into the cooling water of, you know, the ocean or the lake or the river, the radioactive discharges. So could you talk about that? Numbers, fuel pools,
yes,
and
well,
discharges.
The thing about the boiling water reactors, first of all, I'm going to take the last question first, because the discharges are not related exclusively to the boiling water reactors. They're related to what's called the once-through nuclear power plant. So those are the ones that don't have the cooling tower, which is sort of emblematic a lot of times of nuclear power plants. But a lot of them do not have those. And that means that they pump water in from a water source and then they pump it straight back out. And the water that's pumped in and out is used for cooling. So they don't use, you know, they don't discharge steam through a cooling tower. And those reactors, first of all, use an incredible amount of water. I mean, sometimes 1 million gallons a minute, you know, as much as that. And obviously, second of all, they discharge that water at hotter temperatures than the ambient water temperature into which they discharge it, which creates a lot of problems in the aquatic ecosystem. The boiling water reactors, there are, you know, 32 of them, but I think some of them are, you know, worse than others. I don't have the exact numbers on which ones, but they basically have their fuel pools instead of sort of within, you know, most of regular PWRs, the fuel pool is underground.
What's a PWR?
Pressurized water reactors. Yeah. The boiling water reactors, the fuel pools are elevated on the upper story of the building, so they're outside the direct, you know, reinforced containment building. And in some cases, protected really by sheet metal on three of the four sides. So then it means that you could breach that potentially with a small aircraft. You don't need to dive a, you know, large aircraft like we saw on 9/11. Into the fuel pool building to create a catastrophic fire. You also don't necessarily need to level the building. You could crack it, and if the spent fuel pool drains the water out, then you're going to have a similar catastrophe, meltdown, and fire. So these are, you know, all these reactors. We've got 104 operating reactors in the U.S. They're all dangerous. Some of them are very old and in brittle. They have all sorts of problems. But the BWR, the boiling water reactor one, to me is sort of really sitting duck, sort of bombs in our backyard.
I mean, well,
they are, you know, so vulnerable. And it, even though we work, obviously, at Beyond Nuclear to close all of them, those ones we identified as being of the most immediate need to close because the risk, that, you know, the ease with which you could create an accident there or an attack is just, is too great to justify operation.
Well, Linda, how much radioactive waste is in those fuel pools at the moment? I know that every year they take out 30 tons of this incredibly radioactive waste and put it in the cooling pools. So how much is in the pools and what does the waste consist of primarily in terms of the isotopes and what does that mean to health?
You know, you really you need to talk to my husband, Paul Gunn, to get into the technical details because that's not my area of expertise. I mean, I do know that as far as the fuel pool content goes, it obviously depends to some degree on how long the reactor has been operating. In this country, most of them are in their 15-year years. And as you say, after 5 years, they take the rods out after they've cooled enough, and then they put them into the casks, which is not necessarily the ideal solution either, because even these are not protected adequately enough. And we've advocated for many years that they should be in hardened, what we call hardened on-site storage, so they're bunkered and burned and, again, protected, particularly from aerial attack, which is something we have to recognize as a possibility after 9/11 and was even looked at, you know, before 9/11. So I think those, you know, the waste pool issue is very serious for all reactors. But as I said, with the BWRs, they're so exposed, it's greater. But I can't answer this. You may answer that, but I cannot answer
okay,
the isotopic question.
I'll answer it. And I'll refer you to my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming, published by the New Press. In those cooling pools sitting on the roofs of the boiling water reactors, 32 of them around the nation, is as much radiation... Well, the radiation in the reactor itself is equivalent to 1,000 Hiroshima bombs, the long-lived radiation.
Oh, right.
The cooling pools contain 2 to 30 times more radiation than in the reactor itself. And a study was done by von Hippel et al. At Princeton University to show if there was a loss of coolant in the cooling pools, and water must be circulated continuously to keep them cool, and there was a meltdown and a fire. That would be by orders of magnitude far, far worse than an ordinary meltdown in a reactor like Chernobyl that contaminated the whole of Europe. So these are incredibly dangerous things. The isotopes in the cooling pools range from cesium-137 that lasts for 600 years, that causes brain cancer and muscle cancers, strontium-90 that lasts for 600 years and causes bone cancer and leukemia, plutonium that lasts for 500,000 years and causes lung cancer, lymphomas, bone cancer, leukemia, liver cancer, and testicular cancer and abnormalities in the fetus. I could go on and on. We used to have a bumper sticker saying plutonium is thalidomide forever because it does it to... fetus after fetus for the rest of the time because it lives for so long. Those cooling pools are extraordinarily dangerous and they could be melted down not just with an aircraft attacking them but with a shoulder-held missile by a terrorist who just shoots the missile into the cooling pool and, as you say, ruptures the containment or cracks it. Water leaks out and that's it. So I've referenced that Princeton study in the book Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. Okay, now what in the remaining time, we've got about 5 minutes, Linda, what other issues that would you like to address?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the International Atomic Energy Agency as well, because I think that, and a little bit more about the non-proliferation treaty, because I think that sometimes there's a sort of prevailing idea that somehow we're safeguarded by these international bodies. And that although, you know, countries might behave badly, at the end of the day, you know, we've got these international bodies to make inspections and to make sure everything's okay. But I find, you know, with the International Energy Agency, it's sort of, to me, it's straight out of Alice in Wonderland, because their mission is to ensure that countries without nuclear weapons don't develop them. And at the same time, their mission is to promote and market nuclear power to those countries. So, you know, on the one hand you give it, on the other you take it away. I mean, how do you do that? How do you prevent nuclear weapons developing in countries to which you are marketing nuclear power plants? It's completely, it's crazy. And the other thing about the non-proliferation treaty is it's a very generous landlord. You know, if you can sign, as a country, you can sign the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, and you can promise never to make nuclear weapons, and you can build your nuclear, civilian nuclear technology program, and then at the point where you've decided, all right, I'm ready now to transition to nuclear weapons, you give 3 months' notice, and you leave the treaty. And that is exactly what North Korea did. You know, it was a signatory to the treaty, and then when it got ready to make its own nuclear missiles, gave its 3 months' notice and left. And there is absolutely nothing really, other than the sort of heavy and largely failed negotiations that have gone on ever since, that you can do about it. And it reminds me a little bit of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where the Frenchman saying, you know, if you don't leave now, I will taunt you a second time. I mean, really, that's all you can do is make empty threats. And I think that is another fundamental flaw of the system. And what needs to happen is that the nuclear weapons countries must start to hold up their end of the bargain and disarm. And it should be led by powerful countries like the United States. Obama has talked about it. It's time to start dismantling these things, truly dismantling them, and not getting them to sort of thresholds where you can still create a nuclear winter, you know, to really dismantle them. And at the same time, unfortunately, you have to reduce your traditional military power as well, because otherwise countries will just look and say, well, you could still get it, you know. But I think I don't know that I would say I'm a pacifist, but I do really feel that nothing is solved by armed conflict of any kind. You know, when you look in history, there's no real example of something being resolved this way. You know, it's always created horrendous suffering and further problems. And nuclear is sort of the pinnacle of that. Obviously, you know, this is a weapon that is so deadly that the only point in having it is to threaten with it that you will, you know, but obviously you will never use it. You know, it's completely illogical. It's a weapon that's only useful if you don't use it. I mean, is that a weapon then, or is it, what is it? It's obvious that if no one has nuclear weapons, then you can't use them and nothing will happen. So I think that, to me, the nuclear power piece is extremely scary, and we're skating on thin ice and taking enormous risks. The nuclear weapons piece is so heinous and so horrific in terms of the potential outcome, and somebody has to stand up and say, that's it, we're done with this, and really get rid of them. And I think the U.S. and Russia are the two countries that have to do it, because basically we've got almost all of them. The 26,000 or so that are still around. I think people have, you know, when we talked earlier about how little people know about nuclear power, how little people know about how many nuclear weapons are still sitting in those two countries alone. And as you referenced, how many of them are on hair trigger alert and that they can be launched in minutes and take 15 minutes to get to their target and you can't recall them. It's chilling to think of that we could have an accidental launch which you couldn't recall. So it's just not something that is morally acceptable in any way.
Well, it seems like President Obama is really sincerely trying to do something. And I think that when he removed the missile defense systems potentially from Poland and Czechoslovakia, he opened the way for Russia to be more accessible and open to negotiating a treaty with America to, in the end, abolish nuclear weapons. He says, though, that he can't do it alone, that he must have the support of the people around the world. And we had a massive movement in the 80s, 80% of Americans, to oppose nuclear weapons and nuclear war, and that movement must be rebuilt. And as you've described today, Linda Gunter, very clearly, that the movement must also involve the abolition or eradication, well, you can't get rid of them, but of nuclear power plants, closing them all down. Linda, I thank you enormously for the interview, and maybe we'll have you on again in a year's time to update us.
Thank you, Helen. And we should just give the website of Beyond Nuclear, yes, too, which is www.beyondnuclear.org, where you can download any of those materials and reproduce them and use them as you need to.
Please feel free to use their materials from their website and also to help them by donating some money if you possibly can. Thanks, Linda.
Thanks, Helen.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I've been interviewing Linda Gunter, who's a founder of Beyond Nuclear and specializes in researching the French nuclear sector. She's also the media and development director for Beyond Nuclear, and their webpage is www.beyondnuclear.org. I'll now read an excerpt from my new book, If You Love This Planet, published in 2009 by W.W. Norton. Radioactive waste. Oceans are also contaminated with radioactive waste. Sellafield, a large nuclear reactor complex in Britain, has expelled huge quantities of radioactive elements into the Irish Sea, making it the most radioactive sea in the world. The elements include cesium-137, strontium-90 and plutonium-239. When released into the environment, these and many other isotopes concentrate thousands of times at each step of the food chain, from algae to crustaceans to small fish to big fish. It is almost certainly dangerous to eat fish caught in the Irish Sea, and the danger may extend great distances. Not all fish are radioactive, but fish swim thousands of miles, and it's impossible to detect which fish carries radioactivity in their flesh. When humans eat radioactive food, the elements are absorbed through the wall of the gut into the bloodstream to be deposited in specific organs. Strontium-90, which remains poisonous for six centuries, deposits in bone. Cesium-137, equally long-lived, settles in muscle. And plutonium-239 concentrates in bone, liver, spleen and testicles and crosses the placenta into the developing fetus. Although these three elements are all potent carcinogens, plutonium is the most dangerous. It remains radioactive and poisonous for 500,000 years, and just 1 pound, about 0.5 kilo, of plutonium could induce lung cancer in every human lung on Earth if adequately distributed. For example, if I die of a plutonium-induced cancer and I'm cremated, the smoke and plutonium from my body will leave the crematorium chimney and be inhaled by another human being. Thus, the cancer cycle continues ad infinitum. The latent period of carcinogenesis is 5 to 50 years, that is, the period of time before cancer develops after exposure to radiation. By now, only over 1 million gallons of radioactive waste containing, among other elements, about 550 to 1,100 pounds of plutonium have entered the Irish Sea. And whenever nuclear power plants are located, radioactive waste is discharged into seas, rivers and lakes. This is Helen Caldicott, and I've been reading an extract from my new book, If You Love This Planet, published in 2009 by W.W. Norton. I thank you for listening again this week, and we'll be with you next week with another fascinating program from If You Love This Planet. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.